Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
The thing I love to talk to you about the most, Chris Gibson, is your expertise because of your time in the military and because of your thinking about our international posture. I know you've had real guts in talking about how you didn't want to send American troops on adventures to foreign countries if it could be avoided. I guess the first thing I want to ask you about is South Sudan. What do you make of that mess?
Well, you know, certainly very saddened, concerned about the situation in South Sudan. I think it's important that we study this and understand before we take action. And what I mean by that is diplomatic and support operations, that we understand the dynamic there. Some would say that it's all about oil there. Well, certainly oil plays a role, but that was not really, in my view, the overriding consideration or factor that led to this latest flare-up. South Sudan, relatively new nation. A little over 2 years, right?
Yeah, July split from Sudan.
Right. This is July of 2011.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are significant ethnic rivalries that are apparent in South Sudan. The precipitating event that led to the violence was just a couple weeks ago when the sitting president fired his cabinet, including his deputy. And his deputy was the leader of the rival ethnic element. And so, you know, that led to, in five of the 10 provinces in South Sudan, we saw significant violence, and to such a degree that the United Nations now has passed a resolution to support. And, you know, we have actually been involved, our country has been involved evacuating Americans. And we had four of our servicemen wounded in the process of evacuating several hundred Americans that were in South Sudan. So the situation is potentially destabilizing. And I think that what's happening right now with regard to African leadership and the UN is actually positive.
Sure, they're doing it and not us.
They are. And they're actually being, I think that to date, I've been supportive and you know, somewhat impressed by the approach, which is really trying to calm the situation down, bring the leaders to the table to recognize that, you know, the internecine competition between the leadership at the very top of these ethnic groups could have catastrophic impacts for the peoples in South Sudan if they're not able to reach accommodation.
But if they're not, and if the ethnic cleansing and some of the other stuff that goes on continues, does the United States have an obligation to get in there?
Well, judgment matters here, because you could underreact and you could also overreact. And in either case, you could end up in the wrong place. So, you know, I think that the proper judgment here is in supporting the African nations that, and particularly those in the eastern part of the African continent that are looking to play a role here, and also the United Nations that are tempering, because we do have points of leverage. We have points of leverage with this leadership. They recognize that oil is a major exporter. It's the revenues for this country. There are points of leverage that we can have to get them back to the peace table before this becomes a major conflict. Because at the moment, this has really been episodic. There have been certainly skirmishes that have occurred. There's been some level of mobilization, but this has not erupted into a civil war. And I do think that the actions that have been taken at the United Nations and in Africa are actually going to help. And I think we should be supportive of that. I think if we were to do nothing, I think that, that would be the wrong judgment here. And I don't think that that's what the administration's doing. I know that Secretary of State Kerry, it looks like he may even involve former President Bush, what I'm hearing, and with the diplomatic discussions that are ongoing. And to the degree that we can support the UN efforts there, there are peacekeepers that are in South Sudan, and having them in the right place and time and working the conversations and then publicizing the results of those conversations, I think, will go a long way to calming the situation down. And you know, I do believe that this should be we should be able to positively address this.
Chris Gibson, when it comes to the NSA and whether or not Americans are having their phone records, denied by the agency itself, looked into. I mean, you're a congressman, you're a guy who has deep interest in the national security of the country. What are we to make of this?
Well, I never forget, you know, what it is that's driving it. The concern I have for national security emanates from a deep belief that this way of life, this cherished way of life, which protects and celebrates freedoms, is really the genesis for why we want to protect it. So, you know, I don't accept this this premise that we have to give up our freedoms to protect them, give up our liberties to protect them. So in my view, and I've been very vocal about this since the first moments of arriving in the United States Congress, that we're out of balance here. You know, the Patriot Act is, in my view, unconstitutional. It's facially unconstitutional with regard to roving wiretaps. Fourth Amendment explicitly stating that you need specificity in terms of person, place, or thing to issue warrant. Yet in the Patriot Act, it says that's desirable. But if you don't have that, then a general description will work. So we can just roll out in front of your library and just continue to monitor and make what may come out of those surveillance. And that's wrong.
Do you think we're on the road to hell here?
Well, I think we've made a big mistake. And not only this roving wiretap, which is, in my view, facially unconstitutional, but also Section 215. This is the so-called business records section that has been topical. It's been covered in the media as of late because the key word there is relevant. You know, the authority given to the government to collect relevant data as it relates to security operations. Well, you know, that was part of my critique is what do we mean by relevant? I couldn't get a good explanation for that.
And if you want a warrant, you have to go to the secret court. And that's something troublesome to me about a secret court.
Well, I mean, look, here's the central problem here is the word relevant that I had concern with. And I voted against the reauthorization of the Patriot Act in 2011. But what has happened is the administration has come back with a legal definition of relevant. They said everything is relevant. That's how you get the legal authority for the metadata. This is the argument of what they call the haystack and the needle. They want to collect the haystack so that if they ever have to go find the needle, the haystack's already put together. But what that means is that every single phone call, you know, is in this haystack. That's in contravention of our Bill of Rights. You have the right to be reasonably secure in yourself and in your property and your belongings, and that if the government is going to conduct surveillance, there has to be probable cause and a separation of powers, not just the executive branch, because that was one of the things the administration was arguing. Well, we have five different levels of lawyers in the executive branch. Oh, that's nice, but that's not what the Constitution calls for. The Constitution calls for a separation of powers, which means that the judicial branch needs to be involved in this and reviewing. And so, you know, the fact that that we have not writ proper warrants attendant to the Bill of Rights and the Constitution is unacceptable to me, which is why I have supported legislation, which why, number one, why I voted against the reauthorization of the Patriot Act, and why I have co-sponsored and voted for legislation that rolls back Section 215. And you haven't heard the last of us. It was 205 of us that voted to roll back the Section 215 that would have essentially ended the metadata collection absent a warrant. And we only needed that day about 217 votes to carry. So,
now what's the theory behind the secret courts, the FISA courts, and the rest of it? Is the theory there that the judges have to be basically hooded because if they're not, somebody will kill them?
Well, look, I mean, I'm actually okay with the idea that the separation of powers would include a court that is in the judicial branch that will sit and review for the purpose of national security whether or not the administration has a case, whether or not that they'll issue warrant. The fact that we do make those classified sessions, I can live with. However, what I do want is a couple things. Number one is that, you know, when it comes to these matters, the executive branch does not get fiat. You know, there has to come, and that's the problem with the relevant data, is that this metadata is collected for everyone, regardless of whether or not there's a warrant. So there's a problem with the whole construct of the FISA court a priori. The second piece of this is that there ought to be declassified summaries that are providing for the American people what the activities were over the last 90 days of the FISA court, so that the American people and those that you know, that are involved in other levels of government can get oversight, their own eyes on this. So we have in the Congress, we have a select committee for intelligence. I don't sit on that. I am on the Armed Services Committee, but I'm not on the Select Committee for Intelligence. The Select Committee for Intelligence, theoretically, has access to everything. However, we have learned recently, and quite frankly, over the years, that there have been activities that have occurred beyond the purview of the Select Committee on Intelligence, which is abjectly wrong.
So are we heading to 1984, backwards?
I have been concerned. You know, I'll tell you, Alan, I have been concerned about the path we're on. Because, you know, over time, you know, one could get themselves in a spot. I'm not in that spot, but one could get themselves in a spot where they think that we have to sacrifice our liberties for security. And if we end up doing that, and I will fight that, then who are we? Who are we? You know, we're a country that prides ourselves on our incredible and flourishing and free way of life. But if we give that away, then what are we fighting for? Well, this is the point. And by the way, there are those. This is a very interesting issue that cuts across party lines. Because when you look at the vote of the 205 that voted to reform, they were about evenly split between Republicans and Democrats. And I went to a classified hearing where we talked about this, and there was one Democrat who stood up. I won't give her name, and I'll only summarize to the point of declassifying the comments. But she essentially made the point that, you know, if we're going to proceed on this azimuth, you know, then what exactly are we protecting? And that's the point.
Chris Gibson, always wonderful to have you here. You're a good friend to come by and to spend this kind of time with us and to speak frankly and speak your mind. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Alan. I'm looking forward to 2014. God bless all the listeners out there, and hope to see you in the travels throughout upstate New York.